what I find, everybody I work with over my career, including like our COO, for example, I mean, he's basically an urban forestry tree hugger, you know, at this point, because he just, it's so obvious, but you have to kind of open people's eyes to it, I think.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast, a place to explore the emerging technologies and the practitioners that are building greener, healthier, and smarter communities. I'm your host, Nadine Khala, and I'm so excited to be back on the air with season 5 of the Internet of Nature podcast. This season, we explore the future of urban forestry together with Planet Geo, a pioneering urban forest software and consulting company. I partnered with Planet Geo because they are at the forefront of trees and technology, helping communities around the world map a greener future. Together, we've chosen 9 key topics facing the future of urban forestry. In today's episode, episode 1, we're diving into the current state of urban forestry and its prospects for growth in 2023 and beyond with Planet Geo's founder and CEO, Ian Hanau. Ian was one of my first guests on the podcast, for those of you that remember, back in season 1, where we discussed what urban foresters need to know about remote sensing. In the 2 years since, emerging technologies are increasingly being adopted in urban forestry. I feel like this industry is only expanding. So for today's episode, I've recruited Ian's help to not only tell us about the current state of urban forestry and where it's going, but also to help me introduce these 9 key topics and help us understand how these topics are impacting cities around the world. Both my goal and that of Planet Geo's is to uncover what will be needed for urban forestry's success in the future, as well as examining existing practices that can provide us lasting solutions right now. So without further ado, please enjoy my kickoff to season 5 with Ian. Hey, Ian, welcome to the Internet of Nature podcast.
Hello, Nadina. It is great to be here with you again.
Well, this is a very special kickoff to season 5, because not only am I having my first repeat guest on, because you were on in season 1, but we're also embarking on a very special partnership together with Planet Geo for this season. Maybe before we kick off, tell us a little bit about who you are and what is Planet Geo.
Sure thing. And by the way, I can't believe I'm the first repeat guest. That is like beyond an honor. So my name is Ian Hanau, as you said. I'm based in the Denver, Colorado area. I grew up in Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., so the east coast of the U.S., and founded Planet Geo in 2012. I had been doing similar kind of work in the private sector. So geospatial technologies, forest management, software development, project management, things like that for a long time. Growing up in Maryland, I was super fortunate to just literally have a forest and a creek in my backyard. And I'm sure that had a big impact on who I've become. So, Planet Geo's approaching 50 employees, which is crazy and awesome.
15, and 50. It sounded a little like 15, but I just want to make sure that that's clear.
And we are a blend of both software and consulting services for urban forestry and tree care and park management. So our focus is definitely on technology and planning and tools and data around all things urban forestry. And we also operate globally. So
it's funny you mentioned growing up in Maryland around so many trees. That seems to be a very similar origin story to a lot of the guests that I've had on the podcast so far, that trees were, and nature were in some capacity, whether that be in a dense urban core even, like I had a guest, Max Lerner from the New York City Parks Department. He grew up in Lower Manhattan, you could say one of the most tree sparse areas in all of the US. And it was actually that lack of trees that made him really appreciate parks and trees all the much more. to all the way, like someone that I spoke to recently that grew up in a really rural part of Maine that was just absolutely forested. And it just seems like that origin story of having some kind of connection to nature and trees leads to all of these people working in trees and forestry today, which I think speaks to an even broader goal of why we're here sharing this knowledge. So hopefully we can encourage a lot more other people to get into the field as well.
Well, it's encouraging to hear there are people who, the lower Manhattan example, who still say, no, it's a nature versus nurture sort of thing, it sounds like, and that they can come to the green industry side and see the, you know, just inherently see the value and the benefits and why it's so important that our cities aren't gray. So.
Well, and on that note, maybe you can just describe, because of course this season talks about the future of urban forestry, both in 2023 and beyond, and we'll be getting into some of the topics that we'll be covering this season. But before we get into that, just maybe for listeners that aren't familiar, what is urban forestry?
Ooh. All right. So urban forestry is an art and a science and a set of technologies around living green things within our cities and not just outside of cities. So it can be have a lot of different definitions that I've seen over the years. I think it's this awesome nexus of urban planning, community development, social kind of fabric and network of cities, our intrinsic attraction to green organisms, if you will, broadly, right? Just memories of trees in some context or situation, often even smells, all those kinds of things that come together. And then it's this, again, back to the nexus, the management, the maintenance, the care. Like, a lot of people don't connect that these things didn't happen. They didn't just happen, that, you know, neighborhoods and design are very intentional. I mean, certainly some parts of cities, you know, are not as much, but urban forests are this connectivity of green, and they can sometimes include in definition like open space and the connectivity, you know, and trying to avoid fragmented landscapes so that we bring some of those what seem like outside of urban areas back in terms of the important connectivity. So it could be biodiversity and wildlife and obviously all the things like shade and just, you know, beautification. So that's really, I mean, if I back up, that's why I fell in love with urban forestry a while ago. I finished a degree in forest management, and geospatial technologies was my combination, but there was virtually zero urban and community forestry. So I've just grown to appreciate it, the intersection of applying technology, and that's really broad, right? I mean, that could be geospatial technology, but it could be all the way down to planning for the site conditions and environment that are a bit more harsh in cities, typically, where those trees historically and over evolution didn't grow up right with those conditions. So there's like a lot of that adaptation, and it's just a ton of science that also gets blended with social science and the regulatory policy. You can't have a robust urban forest without a bit of all of those things, which I guess that's why I fell in love with it. So I don't know if there's a lot of other things like that in the world. So
I can relate. It's such a unique field, and it goes for urban ecology as a whole. I've always just felt like it's about helping people connect or fostering people's connection to nature where they live. And as we've seen over the last 50 years, and a trend that's only continued to grow, is the fact that the majority of people now live either in a dense urban core, in some kind of urban environment, in a suburban area. And I think no matter where you live, that connection to nature is critical. But if we can make it work with all of the challenges that dense urban cores create, then we can kind of make it work anywhere.
Absolutely. I think if for some of those who know traditional forestry, or at least can more easily understand traditional forestry, that your outputs are paper and timber, right? And you can measure those, and you can choose specific trees and species for environments, and you can, you know, pre-commercial thins, right? And all these sort of silvicultural type of concepts, right? But I mean, if you understand that, then it's a great analogy just to say that urban forestry is about managing and maintaining and caring for trees and expanding upon that so that we have benefits for people. And it's like a different product that you're trying to maximize and optimize for. So yeah, it's people forestry, which is neat. So
exactly. And that brings around, you know, having to optimize trees and forestry for people's benefit. That of course brings with it a whole new set of challenges that forestry did not yet have to concur with. What would you say are still some of the biggest misconceptions around urban forestry?
Well, lack of awareness is maybe the first thing that comes to mind, but that's not really a misconception, you know? Yeah, it's like an oxymoron, right? For a lot of people to think about what do you mean bringing a forest into the city? So yeah, misconceptions, I guess, that the trees need care, that they don't just happen, that there's a lot of thoughtful, intentional decisions around design, preservation, selection, and I just don't think it's obvious to people, right, that all of that happens, and that that it's a public good, right? That most people don't, I mean, they're busy with their day-to-day life and their Netflix shows or whatever, and they're just not necessarily thinking. And what I find, everybody I work with over my career, including like our COO, for example, I mean, he's basically an urban forestry tree hugger, you know, at this point, because it's so obvious, but you have to kind of open people's eyes to it, I think. So I think, yeah, the misconception that that you walking along, whether it's a retail area or a business district or a neighborhood, and that there's this awesome canopy, which a lot of places don't have that and should. And that's what a lot of us are working hard to change. So, yeah, just that this didn't just happen by accident. I know. That's the first thing. What comes to your mind for another maybe a misconception I'm not thinking about?
Yeah, maybe misconception is a bit of a hard word that I use, but probably the first thing that came to my mind was this feeling that people have that the decisions that they make today are only about today. And the fact is, the decisions that we make in urban forestry, unless you're transplanting huge, big, mature trees that, you know, and hopefully survive the transplantation, the benefits that, and of course, if we define urban forestry as managing trees for the benefit of human beings, those benefits aren't going to be felt for 20, 30, sometimes 40 years, sometimes two generations pass. And I think that's a beautiful quote, right? The what is it exactly? The marker of a successful society is when man plants a tree that he knows he won't sit under its shade.
Right.
I butchered that, but something along those lines. And I think that's the beautiful thing about this field is that it's about this working in a field that has this huge sense of legacy associated with it. And I think that's probably something that people are still misunderstanding. It's one of few fields, I think, that exist where you're doing work today that you might not necessarily see all the fruits of your labor in your career, or perhaps even your lifetime. But that's exactly what makes it so beautiful. And of course, a massive challenge that comes with transferring that knowledge, with learning, with innovating. But that's precisely, I think, what makes it so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. When I hate to say it, we have a bit of a throwaway society. And so this is not for those, that mindset. And
no.
Yeah, there's a lot of work you do that's sort of thankless, right? I mean, nobody walks along a street and thinks, or a park and thinks, I am so glad that they have taken care of this and created such, I mean, maybe some people do.
Maybe we should more. Yeah, maybe we should more. So with this for the listeners, your reminder, next time you walk down a dense tree-lined street or your favorite urban park, reflect for a moment about the decisions and the planning, as to speak to your, you know, misconception that it just happened. Trees don't just happen in cities. It takes years and years of planning and hard work and maintenance and monitoring to ensure that those trees survive. They definitely did not just happen.
Yeah. And another thing that comes to mind, it was just that individual decisions really do amount and do.
Yeah.
They do matter in this case, you know, individuals that either want to remove large trees from their properties or, I mean, I constantly hear about concerns of planting like large stature species of trees on properties because, you know, maybe they did see a tree fall and damage property. And I mean, you know, it happens, but we all know in the field and in the scientific area of urban forestry that you know, larger trees, exponentially larger benefits, you know, quantified benefits. But that's a hard sell, I think, it's a big jump for a lot of people to think about that. And then to balance that with maybe, you know, their rose garden in the shade, or the potential risk they perceive. Whereas, you know, you drive around a lot of cities, and I have to think, look at all these areas that are pretty safe. I mean, sure, trees can have branches and such that fail. But even transportation corridors, it's such a huge opportunity in cities, and we can also have a big impact on, say, heat island effect and emissions. But some people say, oh, we could never have trees there. And you look around and go, most cities have lots of trees and canopy in those exact type of areas. So maybe that's a misconception too.
No, absolutely. And maybe building upon that, I feel like urban forestry has gone through many different evolutions in many ways. We no longer just talk about, well, urban forestry is needed for the beautification of cities, that it's needed to be the lungs of the city. We now talk about urban forestry much, much broader, and all of these benefits that we talk about are co-benefits, I guess you could use, everything from the ecological benefits to the economic benefits that are still a lot of people are unfamiliar with, to what they could do for property values, what they do for climate resilience. And one of the things I'm really excited about, more and more research coming out of what they could do for people's health and well-being. So despite kind of all of this massive, it seems like more and more mainstream attention on urban forestry, where do you think urban forestry is in 2023? What is the state of urban forestry, if you will, in 2023?
I like it. Yeah. So I've now been about 20 years in a little over 20 years of my career, but about 20 years almost in urban forestry. So it's pretty cool at that point it's kind of humbling to like be at that point and go, well, I actually have a couple of decades to kind of go. I mean, when I started Plant Geo, I'd have people say, or even before that, they would say, I didn't know you could do that kind of work, meaning kind of intersecting geospatial with planning, with trees, specifically in cities. So it felt awkward to me to be able to answer the question of what I do and why I do it. And part of my initial response to your question, Nadina, is I don't feel as awkward when I explain what I do to people. There's still plenty that are blind to you know, the overall, even maybe just broadly the urban planning realm. But I think where urban forestry is, it's hard to answer that and not mention the federal funding that's going on in the states right now. I know you have a lot of your listenership or audience that's outside of the U.S. We have a federal funded program as of about 6 months ago that is just about to actually take into action and get funded. And it's the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed in Congress. And that to me speaks to where we are for urban forestry in the country. We've got a lot of challenges and we have a lot of opportunities, but if you look at how that funding came about, it wasn't because Congress, in our case, said trees are important necessarily. It was really about inequities and it was about heat. So we took themes, important critical themes that were like, that resonate, and said, people of color have significantly less shade and they're at the highest risk, obviously, of the effects of climate change in those communities. And we showed like redlining practices, which is a thing back from the 1930s in the US. I won't get into describing it in full, but we looked at those, and why it took so long, I don't know. But we looked at that and said, you know, urban forestry is really about people, obviously. And we have such drastic, sharp differences in contrast in what it's like to grow up on a block or a neighborhood, you know, with the environmental justice issues and to not have access to just something as simple as a tree, right? Yeah. And it, you know, when you paint that visual for people and then you use some data and statistics across the country and just show like this isn't this community or that community, it's just about everyone. And we have, whether intentional or not, subconscious or not, we have created cities where people with less income, people of color do not. And again, I don't immediately know about the rest of the world. My guess is it's probably a pretty similar trend. But that's what changed. And that's what created what I think urban forestry is in 2023, which is also a very exciting time. You know, it is a critical component. It is no longer we do a separate tree maintenance plan. Like, no, we're doing climate plans, and these are adaptation plans where we're not just looking at reducing, you know, energy usage, but we're looking at the land base and the natural environment. And like you said a second ago, all of the public health benefits, and we're looking at urban forestry holistically for the first time, I think. And that funding is a great example of just what really was it that tipped the scales. You know, it wasn't energy savings or something. I mean, it was about people and their health, and that it's just not right that some people get access to even like city programs or, you know, and whatnot, where we have a lot of robust canopy, and other areas just truly got left behind. And we're fixing that now. And I mean, we as a country, as federal agencies, state agencies, cities, nonprofits, companies like Planet Geo, you know, we're actually like really focused on that, which is cool to be a part of that movement.
Yeah, and I think for me, the biggest inequality trickles or hones in on the fact that I think for me, it's always been about economics. That is just, if you have lower income, if you live in a lower income area, those areas tend to be historically disadvantaged of having more tree care for a whole number of reasons. It could be that those areas are denser. It could be that land ownership is different. It could be that a lack of ownership for the trees that are planted are. It could be historical disinvestment in those neighborhoods. It could be about a lack of awareness about the benefits of trees. It could be the fact that people undergo really traumatic situations where the root of the tree got into their pipeline, their sewer system, and they had to move because of that, because they didn't have the money to fix it. So there's all these issues that I think really, really come down to the fact of income, and that if you have the money, no matter what you look like, you have the opportunity to live in a neighborhood that the vast majority of people would recognize as being a nicer neighborhood, which is the one that is filled with the parks and the big mature trees. And if you have money, that's the kind of neighborhood you're going to be able to live in. And if you don't, your neighborhood is going to look very differently. And I think there's this such a great idea that now in the society that we live in, that your zip code means more about what your health outcomes are going to be than your genetic code. And that's a pretty stark difference. And it's insane and crazy that it had to get to that point where we had to make that realization. But it is, on the other hand, beautiful that that's now meant, I think it's $1.5 billion federal investment just in urban forestry alone.
Just in urban and community.
Yeah,
that's correct. Just in urban and community forestry.
Yeah, and it's something like
going from 36 or 40 million a year at the federal level to over 300 million for the next 5 years. So it's massive. And there's other examples too. I saw Scotland had I think it was 10 million pounds for urban forestry grants and initiatives. And, you know, so there are certainly others outside of the States. But yeah, everybody is scrambling, and we're scaling, and we're looking at how to hire. And we're all trying to do that at the same time and, you know, create better jobs in this industry for people who can contribute to that. And do a lot of, it's like a whole new set of skills for, you know, you can't just know maybe the regulatory side of things, the land use planning side, or the tree, you know, say arborists, you know, as like tree doctors, right? That's great. We will always need that. But now we're also as an industry, we're going to expand, we're going to change, because we have to have skill sets of, like, you know, do you want trees in your community? Who are the neighborhoods that we can get to? Who are the street mayors, you know, that can help us to say, yeah, we would like our neighborhood to look like that. You know, and back to your point about income, if you're having trouble putting food on the plate, you know, on the table, how are you even going to think about, I mean, buying a tree, let alone watering it, or thinking, what am I going to do when this thing gets big? And, you know, and I think your point about the property was just, home ownership versus, you know, renting. Rental properties have a totally different kind of, you know, mindset around what they want their neighborhood or their landscape to look like. So we have this great resource and this funding, and there's just a lot of great conversation going on around it. Like, it's almost like anxiety around it. You know, we got all this funding, but now how do we leverage that? How do we make it more, how do we make programs that are sustainable and reach new audiences? And some of those audiences aren't going to want trees, and that's fine. You know, and how do we show that there was a need? I mean, we've had a lot of meetings with, at the federal, state, and level, on this the last 6 months or 4 months, and you know, how do we show that there really was a need and we have the capacity across the sort of the web and network of professional and associations and groups to get this money in the right ways, the right places, and show results, which that's a really hard part because trees don't provide instant benefits. So that's kind of what's going on from a federal level quickly at a high level. And I hope I answered, what is urban forestry in 2023? I mean, it's got plenty more to it, right? It's got invasive species issues and, you know, it's got labor shortages and it's got new entities, new players, which is exciting, new technologies, you know, things like that. So, and it's got a lot more, I hope it's got more relevance to people, so.
Absolutely. Yeah. More and more, it seems like, and that's why it feels like now is the right time to do this season together as well. That's all about this future of urban forestry and dive into specifically what are some of the key issues that we're facing in this movement and how might we go about addressing them. So, without further ado, we have chosen 9 key topics within this season that we're going to be covering together with a whole host of different guests. We're not going to get into all 9 per se, but I would like to ask you, which 3 are you most excited about?
So one of the things that was really exciting to us, Nadina, to partner with the podcast for the whole season is you presented the topic about the future of urban forestry and key issues. And for us to be able to, I mean, we interact with a lot of different entities. We have a lot of different, you know, end users and customers and partners. And so for us to be able to contribute to that and, you know, let you run with that we just lined up such great presenters for this season. And to be able to give some input around that was, first of all, just like really an honor and something that we're really proud to participate in. And so, you know, I'll give some examples at maybe like a national level. So like Jad Daly, for example, is up as a speaker, and he's with American Forests. They've been doing incredible work around lobbying, activism, advocacy, workforce development, all about this funding. So, you know, Jad's going to talk about funding. I gave a presentation at the Arbor Day Partners Conference on funding in a few months ago, November, I guess. And really kind of just gave a broad view of what are there's so many creative ways with funding these days, and, you know, entities that are interested in urban forestry and in urban greening and in health and all these. So Jad's going to talk about that. We thought that funding would be really important. We have Dan Lamb from the Arbor Day Foundation. I've known Dan a long time, and Planet Geo is doing some different really like organizing and exploring ways we can sort of contribute and scale. A lot of conversations around the country are about scaling right now and how do we do that together. So that's been exciting. So Dan's going to speak to really kind of like what are some of the best successes and approaches to creating urban forestry programs. And I'll speak a little bit to that today, you know, if we have time as well. And on a local level, I live in between Denver and Boulder, Colorado, right up against the edge of the Rocky Mountains. And I've been working for a little over a year with a guy named Brett Kincairn. He's with the city of Boulder. And he has a super interesting position. It's about, I think, if I recall, it's 70% city responsibilities on climate initiatives and about 30% are national initiatives. And when I heard that, I just thought, I'm not even know if I've ever heard of that before, you know? And we've been meeting regularly for over a year now and met, really connected one another with different networks. I'm working with the Georgia Tech Urban Climate Lab now on some heat mitigation analysis through Brett. He also introduced us to the Urban Sustainability Directors Network. So again, new audiences doing really similar work that where urban forestry, you know, has a nexus with. So Brett's fantastic. He's so motivating and well-spoken and knowledgeable. And every city should have a Brett. And I think he's going to be that local climate action who gets urban forestry, gets people, gets technology, gets funding, you know, and if anything, let's create a program where every city gets a Brett. So I hope those are just 3 of the ones that really stand out in my mind. And there's others that are going to be fantastic. So
Hey, everybody. Thanks again to this season's sponsor, Planet Geo. Planet Geo has a suite of software and services all designed to shift the urban forestry conversation from hypothetical to reality. See the link in the show notes to learn more. And now, back to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to those, listeners can look forward to, we're going to be diving into private tree ordinances, which maybe just quickly, what is a private tree ordinance? Just in quickly in a nutshell, because that word gets thrown around a lot more and more, it's becoming more and more relevant and important, but it still feels like a very technical term to those people outside of the field. So what is a private tree ordinance?
Yeah. Good topic and good question. So, ordinances have been around for a while. I think in Canada, they generally refer to them as bylaws. Mm-hmm. And this basically is about the protection or restriction around trees during development, construction. And there's a lot of, you know, landscaping code where you have specific, say, setbacks during development and creating space and room for trees, right? So it's really all the sets of rules that apply in this particular case around trees and the built environment. And so on private property, it's becoming a bit more, I won't say it's commonplace by any means, but I mean, it's becoming more common that more cities, and this part I know has been talked about on the podcast quite a bit, but the vast majority of land in cities is going to be privately owned. So we have this kind of dichotomy where we think of, some of us at least think of city forestry or city parks as being the drivers, but they can only influence somewhere around 10 or maybe 20, maybe 25% of the landscape. So through a regulatory approach, we have private tree ordinances that come in and say, well, what rules can we protect? So it might be something like significant trees. That could be tree, you know, it depends on the environment. It could be certain species of trees that are protected because maybe they're native, they are, you know, good for pollinators and those kinds of things. But yeah, that's an example where it could be, it's different for every city. And these are difficult processes, but we've actually, the last 3 years, gotten a lot more into providing either public tree ordinances or private property tree ordinances. So we started off with a canopy analysis as like a kind of a core underpinning or bread and butter of what we do, but you're not really going to get much done with that canopy data unless you can take it to that next step, which is often this practice of private tree ordinances. So I could give some examples if you'd like, but anything to add for the listeners about, you know, on the policy side for ordinances?
Yeah, with fear, I mean, and I think we could launch into a whole discussion here because it's a private tree ordinance. I'm glad we're covering because it's a juicy one. At times, it's a controversial one because, of course, you're dealing with property law and almost like a big brother effect that can happen if you've got municipal governments looking into people's backyards and if they are cutting down trees, are they doing that with a permit, without a permit? What kind of is there? Can there be jail time associated with that? Heavy fines associated with that? So it's a controversial, juicy one. So I'm excited to get into that.
Absolutely. And that's why we did a webinar on it late 2022. Yes. Yeah. And
it was so popular. You had two, right?
We ended up having a second one because we were blown away by how many people, participated. And we had Elena Tucker from the Arbor Day Foundation come, and because Tree City USA, which has other programs like Tree Cities of the World and so forth, they have one of their requirements is to have at least a working public tree ordinance. We had them kind of reference that. But she said, these are my people. I can't believe, we had hundreds of people show up and then needed to have a second session. So, and there were so many questions and engagement around how to do this and all the complexities that you were just referring to.
I mean, it's the elephant in the room, right? We can keep going on and on about the benefits of trees, but we cannot, as Matthew Wells, chief public landscape officer of City of Santa Monica says, who was also a guest on season 3 of the podcast, always rightfully says, I cannot outplant private urban deforestation on public land. I simply do not have the room on public land to keep up with the losses that I'm dealing with on private land. So we'll leave it at that as a sneak peek, as a teaser, but that's going to be a good one. We're also getting into something that's relatively new, this idea of treefluencers. So we're familiar with, of course, social media influencers. Farmfluencers has become more of an idea, having this rise of regenerative farming and organic farming, and small-scale urban farmer has led to a whole generation of farmfluencers on social media. There's also plant influencers, which are all about best ways to maintain and keep houseplants. But there we now also seeing a new growth in treefluencers. So we'll be interviewing one of the top, I would dare I say one of the few, but definitely one of the biggest treefluencers out there, Tobin Mitnick, known as at Jews Love Trees on social media, and he has amassed over 500,000 followers. So I think that'll be a whole new perspective on particularly what I'm hoping to get out of treefluencers, or what I hope to see is get a whole new generation of youth excited about trees, meeting them on a platform, TikTok and Instagram, where they already are, and getting them to engage with some different content that they might otherwise be able to see.
I can't wait for that one. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be a funny one. He's a comedian as well, of course, as you have to be when making this kind of content. And speaking of young people, we are going to be getting into labor shortages, which has been a massive issue that's been plaguing the field of urban forestry for a while. But as you mentioned, with this huge ramp up in investment and media attention, we are going to need a lot more people getting into this field. And we are already dealing with a labor shortage. So we're going to have Leslie Burks from the Society of Municipal Arborists that is talking about that, which I think will be really interesting. I know that's one of her key goals. She just recently started heading up that organization. So I know that's one of her big goals. How do you feel about what's your perspective on the labor shortage facing the urban forestry market?
Yeah, it's become one of the biggest topics the last couple of years. Just last week, I was in Washington, D.C. at the annual Sustainable Urban Forestry Coalition meeting. And it's more policy advocacy. And the presentations this year were almost all around workforce development and apprenticeship programs. And so there was a group in Chicago called Open Lands that presented on how they're developing their apprenticeship program. So I've noticed a lot of grant opportunities.
We have a community arborist, Tom Ebling from Open Lands, also speaker on this season of the podcast, talking specifically about, we want to do all these tree planting campaigns, but how can we ensure those trees are not only established, but also cared for by the people that are living amongst them? And they've got a fantastic program that's been going on for decades called Tree Keepers, which have really helped. And it's an apprenticeship program that trains people, pays people to become these tree stewards. And I think it's a program that can be not easily, but can be replicated in many, many cities around the world, I would say.
Yeah, that's great. So I think it is, it's just a dire need right now. We cannot, you go to any tree care company, you go to an environmental nonprofit, you go to a city forestry, almost everybody is looking for skilled labor in tree care or some related, you know, facet of it. So it's not an area where we directly at Planet Geo can do much about, right? But, you know, we have the same issue, right? We need to hire the right people with the right skills and for today and for tomorrow. And so I guess I'm just really excited that there are so many initiatives going around and like funding opportunities. You know, the IRA funding I was talking about is not just to plant trees it's really about community engagement. And I think linking up local economic development, that could be wood utilization related. So that's another thread or tie into this for sure. That's really a strong argument. I mean, think about creating neighborhoods where they don't have to be concerned about maybe tree risk, because it's actually in the best incentive for a local tree care company to come take that tree down when it does need to come down. I mean, in an ideal world like that, you'd be able to solve that pretty easily, you know, have programs that take that into account and actually make some, you know, lemonade out of lemons, I suppose, right? So anyway, I drifted a little bit, but hopefully that Makes sense.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe a last topic that we'll tease is that of, which I know is very close to Planet Geo's heart and mine, of course, is data-driven decision-making, which, you know, that term has gotten a lot of buzz in all kinds of different industries. But I think everything that we've touched upon in terms of these topics and in terms of these speakers, is this critically important role that I think is only growing, that shows that you need good, reliable data to back up these conversations, whether you need to be persuading people, convincing people, building a business case, calculating the return on investment from these big investments. Having good data and good maps to know where to start is critical to the success of a lot of these initiatives.
You're telling me.
No, no, preach it to the choir here. But tell us a little bit more about your perspective on data-driven decision-making in urban forestry.
Yeah, I often have people kind of pause and they'll say data-informed, you know, data-driven, two Ds, it kind of rolls off the tongue. But yeah, a lot of times people are more comfortable saying data-informed, which is, I think it's totally appropriate. So, but you know, to your question, that's really like why I started Planet Geo. I had a skill set. I saw a need for something that cities need to be monitoring their tree canopy cover, you know, using aerial technologies. And that they can, I mean, it's just the whole picture makes, you know, takes 1,000 words, and you can just instantly, I think having higher frequency because technology and certain, you know, geospatial availability, right, is like, has expanded so much, and so many companies, large ones, have gotten into, you know, various data intelligence, right? That we actually can more affordably, and then of course like AI and machine learning and all of that part of it, we can more affordably and in new ways be detecting things around cities. They could be like mobile vehicles, they could be drones, more satellites that are available. Well, what this really equates to in my mind is that being a more agile approach to saying, we can see and show people where we're like your example with Matthew Wells in Santa Monica. I know Matthew pretty well. And I remember, I mean, we had him on one of our webinars about that topic. And to be able to show people that, you know, I'm not just saying we're having issues on private property or in disadvantaged communities, but to be able to pull that data easily, readily, and update it pretty frequently. I mean, it's the cost is not that great relative to the cost of lots of other things. And so to me, that kind of ability to monitor nationally, regionally, and locally, either from above as well as, you know, also importantly on the ground in different ways, it just drives a lot of decisions. We can always try to place dollar values on trees, but being able to just see this and have that kind of at your fingertips, I know personally, I mean, if I was either a city forester or a nonprofit, you know, doing urban forestry work in a city, I'd want to have that constantly and be able to use that to say, we need a plan, we need better partners, we need better policies, you know? So to me, some of the most successful urban forestry programs that are there, that are here now, which hopefully can be models and get replicated by other cities around the world, are the ones that have that kind of trifecta, or, you know, it's you have to have some, you know, government and regulatory framework. But the private sector and the private property, land base, and then that nonprofit or community foundation or social enterprise, I think I've seen, for example, California, almost every city over say 25 or 50,000 population seems to have a nonprofit there. And that's like, that didn't just happen. Right. So that kind of model can enable you to do so much. And again, you can have a data wealth, but if you don't really know how to apply it. So we often really want to start with like, well, what are the key management or.
What do you want to do with this data? Yeah,
absolutely. And then let's figure out how we help you put that together. So, yeah, I mean, we're even moving more in the direction of having more readily available data products that are pointed around these management and policy kind of objectives and community engagement aspects. So, but we also know that it does take handholding, and it takes asking the right questions to make sure you're aligning information so that it's actionable. So
exactly. I was just going to say, I mean, just measuring just to measure something is not going to do anything. right? I mean, if you think about it, like I always kind of relate it to like the advent of the Fitbit. I mean, the reason why that took off and the reason why it's still so successful today is because people took direct action based on that data. They looked at their smartwatch or on their phone and they were like, oh my goodness, I thought I was at 10,000 steps. Turns out I'm only at 2,500. Like I better get out there for a little after dinner walk to make up for it, right? It has direct actionable steps that you take. And I think that's the same. I mean, that's the same in any industry, but specifically with urban forestry, where, you know, we don't have time. I mean, it's urgent. We needed these trees yesterday. So we don't have time to mess it up. We need to take informed decisions with the community to be able to implement successful projects. I mean, that's really what it's about at the end of the day for me. Speaking of successful urban forestry projects, what would you say are some of your favorites from around the world? Well, favorites. I'll leave. What is one urban forest or urban forestry project that you're really excited about?
Ooh, project. I don't know if I have one, right? Maybe I have different things to highlight about different ones, but we've worked with Washington, D.C. quite a bit over the years. Our first canopy analysis with them was 2006, and it's also the nation's capital here. And Earl Utzler is going to be, I believe, one of the presenters this season. And we were this October 2023 is the World Forestry, World Urban Forum on Urban Forestry.
World Forum on Urban Forestry. Woof. And who is Earl? Maybe we should quickly introduce who Earl is.
Of course. Yeah. He is the state forester, which is an interesting thing just because DC is technically not a state, but that, you know, it is a district but it has a state forester and it's Earl. And we worked with him a long time. He is an arborist. He's a utility arborist previously. He's an urban forester. So because it's sort of a city state, if you will, he is effectively the urban forester for the District of Columbia. And it's a huge responsibility because you have a unique, like 30 or 40% federal property land base. So there's federal agencies, right? That all the monuments and memorials and so forth. But we've submitted, I don't know if it'll be selected, but we've submitted a presentation for the conference in October around the four different time periods every 5 years of a very detailed canopy analysis. And they've also just benefited by having really good funding, really good partners. They can do a lot, and they can do a lot of interesting, creative things. They are, I believe, just recently releasing a master plan as well. And I at least wanted to touch on that because to me, management plans, like a strategic urban forest management plan, is still something growing in how common that is. But master plans is something kind of a higher level that. I think at least outside of the U.S., I haven't seen too many, and it's relatively new here, the last 10 years or so. And to me, a master plan has elements of management, but it takes a higher level, broader approach. We're doing one right now in Fort Worth, Texas, so one of the largest cities in Texas. And I love how it was funded, by the way. There was basically a very pro-tree, pro-urban forestry developer and said, like, look at these issues. Look at where we're going. It's in the wrong direction. I'm going to put up some funding and go use this to get funding from other organizations. So they had a regional electric utility company come in and several others. And so they have this really diverse set of funding, including with the Texas Trees Foundation. It's a nonprofit that we've worked with a long time, but me probably over 10 years. So they're kind of leading the project. We're the expert consultant on the urban forestry side. But again, putting a broad view of what is the vision for the urban forest. Yes, that's going to have management components, but how are we bringing in the arts? Are we bringing in extreme heat? Are we bringing in the partners, the funding that's sustainable, that's going to make that long lasting impact and creating a shared vision? And if you read a tree maintenance plan for a hospital or a campus, it's not the same scale, right? And you don't have the same purpose. So I think that is something that is just a tremendous value. So I kind of flowed from Washington, D.C., having a lot of good data and resources and their master plan to an example in Texas. But we're seeing more of those, and we're also seeing more, I guess, scope of a project that is broader to include some data analysis and planning and community engagement, maybe some kind of field work. But having that set of core information, as well as, you know, your understanding of how cities can mainstream urban forestry across departments to really to not be in conflict with one another, but have those shared goals and that shared vision, I don't see how else you do it, you know? So
right.
I'm a big proponent of that. And as you probably know, the process of going through that and the relationships and the trust that that builds and the network that that builds, and then having programs that can live on, obviously, like at the implementation phase, and then being able to monitor that, you know? So it's a very, that's really how we've kind of like organized our company is to be able to look at that cycle or those flows from assessment to and data to planning, policy, engagement, and then implementation tracking towards that. And that's, I won't say a whole lot more of the secret sauce, but like, that's the direction we're going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it speaks again to something that I think is reflected in all of the 9 topics that we're going to be covering on this season together, not just about why are urban forest departments chronically underfunded? How can we access some of this huge investment that's happening? I would say most importantly, how do we get communities engaged with that? So it's not just coming from the top down, but it's really coming from the bottom up and really a true collaboration that balances tree stewardship with a feeling of both perceived and in reality ownership of that tree. How do we monitor that? How do we excite people about it? I mean, we're covering a lot. So if I had to ask you, Ian, in 1 or 2 sentences, why should people tune in to season 5 of the Internet of Nature podcast?
I couldn't be more excited about the lineup that we have. So really it's the depth and breadth of expertise, knowledge, passion and innovation, I think that you're going to see from all the presenters. So my example of Brett from Boulder, I hope you spend the hour with him. I mean, you're going to get so many actionable examples of how to put some of the best practices in place and you know, hopefully be able to run with that in your community and share that as examples. So we have a absolute rock star lineup of guest speakers on what is a very broad and important topic of just what is the future of urban of success in urban forestry at a time when there's so much more awareness of what it is, funding availability, and the timing is really good for that. So
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. It's going to be a fantastic season. I'm really looking forward to it. For the listeners, you are going to hear Ian again on episode 10 of season 5. So at the very end, Ian and I are going to have a little bit of a reflection in terms of what we've learned of this past season and what we'll be taking forward from it. So this isn't the last that you've heard of Ian. But in case you can't wait, Ian, what is the best place for people to connect with you and with Planet Geo online?
Ooh, all right. So online, I'll answer that first. I'm certainly on LinkedIn quite a bit. I love, what's the phrase? My network is my net worth. That's one obvious area. But Planet Geo, which, you know, is me in a lot of ways, right? Like, we produce a lot of content. One area we share, like a lot of resources, is what's called our resource library on our website. So that's a great area where most of its content we're involved in some way or another, but it could be webinars, it could be blogs, it could be reports and plans and things of that nature. So I would check that out. We're on, of course, the primary social media. We are planning some big events this year as well. So we have some in-person workshops that are going to be joined with major events like maybe ISA and hopefully in Washington, D.C. in October for the World Forum. I believe we're doing, I don't think all the details are yet, but I believe we're doing a Tree Plotter software user conference that's going to be online and virtual later this year.
Ooh, so that's very exciting.
It's like a professional bucket list item. So I just said, we need to do this. And then I think in 2024, we'll probably do it in person, but yeah, it was a good place to start. So those are a few of the things that, yeah, the where you can find me online and otherwise. So.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And we should also mention that for every episode of the podcast, there will also be an accompanying blog post as well with some more information. And there may even be some ISA CEU credits in the works for podcast episode, as was the case with almost all of the episodes in season 3 as well of the Internet of Nature podcast. So stay tuned for that. So lots to come. And if you've had all 10 episodes of the podcast, it's not enough. Definitely check out the resource library that Ian was mentioning, because there's a whole host of different past and upcoming webinars and blogs and resources, and there's a lot of great stuff on there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Ian, well, to wrap us up, I will ask you the question once again, because of course I did do this on season 1, so I don't know if you remember what you said then, but it would be kind of funny to compare the answers side by side, so we'll see. But it is, of course, the question that I ask all of the guests who come on the show, and that is, what does the Internet of Nature mean to you?
I have no idea what I said a few years ago. I was thinking the same thing. So it doesn't matter. I'm going to say what it means to me right now, today.
Good.
It means to me a place where like-minded individuals can speak about their knowledge and their passion on urban greening. And it can go in so many directions, which is what's awesome. I mean, it could be social, it could be ecological, it could be policy. It's a place, in a sense. Like it's a safe place to really dive deep and get off track, and that's okay, to talk about people who care deeply about bringing nature, whether that's trees or so many other things, into our society, and creating programs that are long-lasting, all around that. So that, at a core, that's really what it is to me. It's a place. And beautiful. Thank you for creating it.
Well, thank you so much to you and to the rest of the team at Planet Geo for partnering on this together this season. It's truly an honor, and it's something that I had hoped would be in the works for a while. So the fact that it's finally here means a lot to me. So thank you.
Awesome. Likewise.
Okay, listeners, you are going to hear from Ian again at the end of episode 10. So we hope you enjoy the season, hope you learn something new, hope it inspires you and encourages you to get outside and get involved with trees and with urban forestry in whatever way that makes sense to you. So thank you, Ian, and listeners, enjoy.
Thank you for listening to the Internet of Nature podcast. Want to learn more about the Internet of Nature? Subscribe to my newsletter at nadinachala.com. I'm looking forward to bringing you another great guest next week. As always, remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review if you learned something new. The best way to support us is to share this episode with a friend or colleague. Season 5 of the Internet of Nature podcast on the future of urban forestry is brought to you by Planet Geo. See you next week.